This is the second podcast lecture in this course. Apparently, for all I know, it's also the second podcast lecture in this university and the second podcast lecture in this city, which I don't believe, but that's what they told me. You may have seen the publication in the New York Post. You may have seen New York One. And you might also expect that Channel 7 will be here next week to make further fuss about it. Some of you guys may even be interviewed. Okay. Now, seriously. What can I tell you? I have given some thought over the weekend about... I'll be quiet. this whole thing. And it seems to me that if you are going to provide the text, the spoken text, you need also the images. And so I plan to post the PowerPoints of the lectures as well as the spoken text on the podcasting. So you will have it all. Do with it. Do the best with it. But do me a big favor. I depend on an audience to give a good lecture. Okay? If you're all going to stay away, the deal is up, folks. Okay? So that's the deal. Please do stay here and I can talk to you and with you and you can ask questions and I'll be happier. All right. Now, to business. We are going to talk today about skull development. It's the last of a series. And today we will talk about the bones that are formed as a result of endochondral ossification. Now, you have already seen a whole series of bones developing, membrane bones. And in the case of the mandible, you saw the development of an interesting bone that forms by both intermembranous and endochondral ossification. And today we are going to look at the bones that form from the chondrocranium. And again, I want you to be aware that the chondrocranium that you see here outlined in dark blue is going to contribute in some ways to the developing skull. And so today we are going to look at the bones that are at this point still indicated as cartilage of the chondrocranium. Just to review this again, and as I have said to you before and during the small group sessions, you are responsible for this much on the chondrocranium. You should know that there is a precordal part of the chondrocranium which is anterior to the notochord. And then there is a caudal part of the chondrocranium, which is more posterior, and that is the part that surrounds the notochord. And of course, this interrupted line, this dark line in the middle, is the relative location of the notochord. So caudal and precaudal, that's the first concept of the chondrocranium. And then in each of these two components, in the precaudal as well as the caudal, there are several structural parts. And the structures that you're seeing here are subdivided into three. One is a group of cartilages that surrounds the organs of special sense. And in the precordal part that you're seeing here, they would be the nasal capsule and the ala orbitalis, also sometimes called orbitosphenoid. It's another term that you run into if you do. Don't get excited. It's okay, you will live, okay? But ala orbitalis is the preferred term here. So those are the ones surrounding the organs of special sense. Then there is a second group of cartilages which is located centrally in the base of the skull. And in the case of the precordal components, you have the trabeculae cranii, originally two bars, but now fused together, so that is trabeculae cranii here. And the hypophysial cartilage, which is located over here, there is a central opening in the hypophysial cartilage. That is to permit the epithelium of Rettke's pouch to penetrate and reach the area of the cella turcica. So these are the two components in the central part of the precordal chondrocranium. And then the third is a part that partially encases the growing brain. And that, in this case, in the precordal component, is the ala temporalis. Now this is that small, it's really a very small part of what is going to be the greater wing of the sphenoid bone. The sphenoid bone does not, the entire greater wing does not form from this particular structure, only a part. So these are the three basic sets of components that are contributing to the precordal chondrocranium. And then you can do the same thing for the chordal, where you say there is an organ of special sense. There's only one in this case, and that's the otic capsule surrounding the organs of hearing and balance. And then, importantly, in the central part, in the base of the skull, you have the paracordal cartilage, that ancient cartilage that is the first to form and that goes all the way from the cella turcica to the anterior margin of the foramen magnum. And also, but not visible here, there are a series of occipital sclerotomes. They are sitting on the lower surface of the paracordal cartilage, and they are going to become the occipital condyles. And then finally, again, there is one piece of cartilage that encases the brain, or attempts to, and does a fairly decent job here, and that's known as the tectum. So these are the components that you need to know. And in each case, when you look at the section, as we have done already before, in the case of the fetus, you should be able to say, well, that is this part of the chondrocranium, for example, this is the otic capsule, and it is going to give rise to, and then you should know that too. Okay, so that is the knowledge that you should bring to this particular structure. Now let's go and look at the chondrocranium, and we begin by looking at the notochord for a moment. The notochord is, in fact, kind of undulating here. It started out straight. It started out pretty much like this. But by the time the cartilage actually formed, the paracordal cartilage, by that time, the notochord has a shape that is something like this. It has this almost sinusoidal curving shape. Why that would be so, people really don't know. Perhaps what is happening is the notochord may continue to extend for a while, and while it extends, it cannot grow further forward because the pituitary gland is here and in a sense prevents the notochord from growing forward. So that is a possibility. We really don't know for sure. But the notochord has this unique curving path. And so it is literally going into the cartilage and out of the cartilage and then back into the cartilage. So here it's in the cartilage, here it's in the cartilage, but here it's outside the cartilage. And in fact, it is so far outside the cartilage that it is actually touching the epithelium of the pharynx. And that epithelium of the pharynx occasionally is being pulled into a little pocket as further growth occurs. And that is known as the bursa pharyngea. It has absolutely no meaning except that when you see it, you see a little depression in the cranial base, you should be aware that that is happening. So the bursa pharyngea is originally a little pocket of epithelium, and as the cranial base continues to grow further, it might actually be a little depression in the pharyngeal surface of the cranial base. Bears like it. If you are a bear, you use it for phonation, but you are not bear, so I don't think it's mattering very much. So in some animals, it really actually is a structure that has a function. In us, it really does not. But that's one of the structures that you can find. Occasionally, this epithelium actually gets enclosed, and then it can give rise to pathology. I have described that in your manual. It's not something you have to learn for your exam. But again, for those of you who are clinically oriented and want to know something about what you might get into in the future, you will at least see something that might be of interest. So there are actually two possible changes in the basic cranium, you may see a little canal here, and that is the craniopharyngeal canal. The craniopharyngeal canal is the canal in the cranial base below the sella turcica that contains remnants of Rathke's pouch. And then the other thing is the bursa pharyngea that may give rise to a cyst or to a little depression in the cranial base. So this is interesting stuff that can happen. Now, in the area of the synchondrosis, where the notochord ends, you may occasionally see a little remnant of the notochord. Those of you that are going to look today at section 15 are going to see it. Others that are going to look at the introduction will see it in this way. So that will be a remnant of the notochord. As you know, in the rest of the body, the notochord forms little swellings between each somatic segment, and those swellings will become the future nucleus pulposus between two vertebral bodies. In the case of the skull base, we have three of these swellings, which may make us believe that there are three occipital sclerotomes. There is some argument in the literature whether it is three or four, but based on the three swellings of the notochord, we assume that it is three. Okay, but you will see occasionally somebody saying there are four swellings. So that is something, the occipital sclerotomes, which are a little bit further posteriorly, we designate that on the basis of the three swellings of the notochord that we find in the cranial base.
Is that
something? Yes.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
That slide, that's an axial section?
This slide here is a sagittal section. Okay? If by axial you mean longitudinal, it is longitudinal, but it is sagittal. No, it's not that.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah? So here is, this here is the posterior clinoid process. Here is the pituitary gland. Okay? Anterior, posterior. Clear? Good. Okay. Now, have we done this? Yeah. What are the possible fates of the condocranium? We have gone over this before, but today it becomes real. First of all, there can be resorption without replacement. And there are parts of the nasal capsule, specifically the parts that are going to be covered by the frontal process of the maxilla, that will resorb, and since their function, their skeletal function is taken over by the maxilla, there is no replacement. So that's one possibility. We will not talk about it today. We will talk about this, endochondral replacement. And the cranial base components that we're talking about today are the examples for that. And finally, there will be the persistence of certain permanent cartilages in the skull. And the example for that are the nasal septal cartilages, and indeed also the external nasal cartilages that you have by now dissected. I think you have seen those. All right. There are essentially four major bones in the skull that are formed either by complete endochondral ossification or by a mixture of endochondral and intermembranous ossification. And I will now go over each of these individual bones. We start with the ethmoid. The ethmoid is a delightful bone because it is formed entirely by endochondral ossification, so there is no big deal here. The ethmoid, seen from above, forms the nasal septum, and that is a cartilage that will... the nasal septal cartilage will in fact remain as a permanent structure, and then it will form the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone, and you have the crista galli, which you see here, that is sticking out in the cranial cavity, the cribriform plate on either side of the crista galli, and then the membranous labyrinth on the side here, which is formed by the external nasal capsule. So essentially then, nasal septal cartilage and the perpendicular plate are formed by the trabeculae cranii, and the labyrinth with the cribriform plate is formed by the nasal capsule. Okay? So the external structures are formed by the nasal capsule. You're seeing it here as an image from below. This is in the fully formed adult skull, and you can clearly see here these little openings in the cribriform plate of the ethmoid peeking right into the cranial cavity. Have you dissected the orbit? Yes, you have. And so you have, in fact, followed the ethmoidal branches, anterior and posterior ethmoidal arteries, and they are leaving the orbit and go through the area, the openings of the cribriform plate and go straight into the nasal cavity. So this is an area that you now know a little bit about. Now, the nasal capsule is also known as the ectethmoid. It is the external components of the future ethmoid, and you're seeing it here in this particular picture quite nicely. You're seeing this here, you see this very nicely, and here over here also. Now, what ideally we would like to do is to have the whole structure intact, but as you already know, the inferior concha is going to be broken off and the inferior concha becomes a separate bone. So that is a separate structure bilaterally that undergoes endochondral ossification. The rest of the ectethmoid gives rise to the lateral labyrinths and the superior and middle concha of the ethmoid. So the rest of that over here becomes the actual lateral components of the ethmoid. As I already said, the ectethmoid also gives rise to the cribriform plate and the permanent cartilages, which are the lateral nasal cartilages, the greater alar cartilage and the lesser alar cartilages that you can see with variable success in the cadaver. Here's an interesting picture that you may, it's in the atlas, but you also will see it in some of the slides. And you're seeing here these little columns, whoops, wrong way. You see here these little columns of cartilage, and those are actually the places where you have the openings in the cribriform plate. So over here, blood vessels and nerves can actually cross through. These structures over here are the superior and the middle concha of the ethmoid, and here is in fact what is going to be the future lateral nasal cartilage of greater alar cartilage, and then here are some cartilage structures of the inferior concha. Yeah.
Those cartilages inside bone, that's from transdifferentiation?
No, they are all going to undergo endochondral ossification. What you have is a whole series of ossification centers that are going to individually develop into bone, and then gradually they all fuse together into one structure. Actually, the number of ossification centers you really don't care to know about. They are so humongously large, but in the end, all of them fuse together into one structure that we call the ethmoid. Okay? And now what you're seeing here, and this is, it's important for you to realize, this is an area near the midline. And here is the cartilage that is essentially what you would call nasal septal cartilage. Really, it's the old trabeculae cranii. But what this is going to become, all of this cartilage continues up all over here. And that single mass of cartilage is going to become the crista galli, is going to give rise to the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid. And then the vomer, of course, as you will recall, will cover this part of the cartilage up. But this cartilage then is going to be bone here. It's going to remain cartilage here, and it's going to be covered by bone over here. At some point over here, the old trabeculae cranii were next to the hypophyseal cartilage. And you notice something very interesting. All these cartilages form one continuous mass. And now what is going to happen is you're going to have individual areas of endochondral ossification. There will be, in this particular area, there will be one here and one here. There is, as we said, the bone is going to form here. So that's an endochondral ossification center. And here is going to be an endochondral ossification center. So what you have is you have one continuous mass of cartilage, and now individual ossification centers will start to form inside that mass. To complete the story of the ethmoid, what you're seeing here now, this is a really nice picture. If you remembered the previous one, this cartilage here, now turn it around 180 degrees, this what you have here. So this is the nasal septal cartilage that stays. This is the perpendicular plate of the ethmoid and the crista galli, and the perpendicular plate of ethmoid formed by endochondral ossification that was going in this direction, and then it stopped here. And wherever it stopped, that is the boundary between the perpendicular plate and the nasal septal cartilage. Again, as I said, the vomer is membrane bone forming on the outside of the nasal septal cartilage. And that means that there is cartilage between those two plates of membrane bone. Little cartilage remnants. Here's what actually happens. What you're seeing here, and it is kind of a complicated picture, concentrate on this one up here. You see here the bone of the maxilla, the two palatal processes of the maxilla. You're seeing here the vomer, this little U-shaped structure, those are the two plates of the vomer. And then in dark is the nasal septal cartilage. And now when you translate this rather strange picture into this simple set of diagrams, what you're seeing here now is the cartilage. These are the ultrabeculae cranii, that's the cartilage. And you're seeing now the vomer growing up to about this point. And that's where it stays in this series of pictures. And now what you're seeing here, gradually, the perpendicular plate of ethmoid is expanding down to this by endochondral ossification. And that endochondral ossification roughly stops near the upper border of the vomer. So where that perpendicular plate ossification process meets the upper edges of the vomer, that process stops. And so this cartilage here stays. There's a little bar of cartilage that stays in the center of the vomer, and that is one reason why you sometimes can have a chondroma in the nasal septal region inside the vomer, which is really a membrane bone. So much for the ethmoid. Are there any questions at this point? Is it clear? Okay, then we move on. And now we go to the temporal bone, which is really a much more complicated bone. The ethmoid was simple, straightforward, endochondral ossification. But the temporal bone is more like what we saw in the case of the mandible. It will form in part endochondrally and in part intramembranously. And the pieces are relatively straightforward. If you remember the neurocranial flat part of the temporal bone, the squamous part, that forms intramembranously, and part of the zygomatic process forms, of course, intramembranously. And then you have the tympanic ring, which is shown as this little ring-like structure here. Those two structures form intramembranously, and at some point they fuse together. And they lie on the outside, and initially they are quite separate from the cartilage that is going to give rise to the petrous part of the temporal bone, and that is the what starts out as the otic capsule. So the otic capsule gives rise not only to the petrous part of the temporal bone, but also to the mastoid process. And it does so by endochondral ossification. Again, multiple ossification centers. It's quite a mess, but gradually these ossification centers all fuse together into one solid piece of bone. As I told you a little while ago, that bone is very resistant to remodeling. It just sits there. And it is one of the few areas in the body where you can find primary osteones. There is no real significant amount of remodeling taking place. The bone just sits there and becomes more and more mineralized, which is why it is called a petrous bone. It's rock-like. And that's exactly what you have here. So as you're looking at this now, look at this diagram and now look at the diagram next to it. It makes sense that the squamous part of the temporal bone, which is really part of the rest of the neurocranium, would form by intramembranous ossification. So that that is a really a perfectly normal thing to expect. Now, this is a picture that is in your atlas, which shows you the complex nature of the temporal bone. And you're seeing here, and I will just want you from here to here, what you're seeing is literally a sliver of membrane bone that sits there. And that is, in this particular case, the squamous part of the temporal bone. That just forms on the outside. And it literally is like a little cover on a pot. It covers over the area of the future middle ear. So this would be the middle ear. And the middle ear contains here what we already know is the malleus and the incus, the two of the three ossicles that you find here. So within this bone that is already complex in nature in the way it forms, you find also enclosed these little structures, these ossicles that form from the pharyngeal arch cartilages. Then what you have over here, this structure, of course, is the otic capsule, and you're seeing here some sections through the utricle and the saccule, where some of the semicircular canals are coming together. And here you see some cuts through what is going to be the cochlea of the inner ear. So these structures are present, the cartilage has formed around it, and what you will find after a while is ossification center, ossification center, ossification center, and gradually all those centers expand and then they fuse together. So this then becomes the petrous and mastoid parts of the temporal bone. One final addition, just to make things jolly, is part of the Reichert's cartilage, which is this second pharyngeal arch cartilage. That cartilage here gives rise to the styloid process, which is added on to the temporal bone. So you have that, just for a final little complication. That again is endochondral. Okay, so this is endochondral. And finally, this here is intramembranous. Okay. Now we move on to the occipital bone. The occipital bone, again, is formed by two mechanisms, intramembranous and endochondral. And in this particular diagram, you actually see some of the ossification centers. In the area of the tectum, you have a couple of ossification centers. In the paracordal cartilage, I'm sorry, the paracordal cartilage is here, I should say. That's going to form the basioccipital. And then in the area of the exoccipital, which is the sclerotomes, and you're seeing it now for the first time, the area, the sclerotomal region, the exoccipital is going to form, in part, the condyle of the occipital bone. But you notice here that there is a boundary, and the boundary now shows you that in this area, the so-called upper part of the supraoccipital, you're seeing membrane bone. And so the supraoccipital really is formed in part by endochondral ossification and in part by intramembranous ossification. And there again are multiple ossification centers here, two at least, probably four, in this area. This bone in some animals does not become part of the occipital and becomes a separate bone, the interparietal. So the fact that you have it added onto your occipital bone is just one of those situations where if the two bones fuse, it becomes one bone and you have a different situation than some other animals do. So now here's an interesting thing. You saw those terms, basioccipital. Basioccipital is here. That is the old paracordal cartilage. And here is exoccipital. That is occipital sclerotomes. And here is supraoccipital, which is tectum. Okay, those are the three basic sets of components that are giving rise to the occipital bone. And you notice now how these ossification centers, which are marked here in black, can in fact form in this area here, in this area here, but right over here there is a piece of cartilage that remains for a while. And what you typically find, and that is what you see here, in the adult skull, you frequently see a little cleft in the occipital condyles. And when you see the cleft in the occipital condyles, what it means again is that the endochondral ossification centers did not come all the way together. And when there is still a little bit of cartilage left in between that will persist into adulthood, you get these clefts. You don't see the cartilage in the bony skull, but you do see the clefts, and that just means that there was cartilage there that was never removed. Okay? So that is one of the real problems. If you have multiple ossification centers, most of the time they fuse together and it's all one continuous piece of bone. But if the cartilage remains between two ossification centers, you get these little discontinuities, and in that case you frequently see that. Now, here is a somewhat hazy diagram, but what you're seeing here now is in fact a side view of the intercorietal part of the occipital bone, that is the membrane part. You see the little bone trabeculae forming, and here is the supraoccipital part of the membrane bone that is formed by endochondral. And for a while you can see that they are quite separately. By the way, this is a lovely, lovely picture of the frontal bone. So, but for a while you can see these two structures are quite separate. And indeed, by the time you're born, there is still not a complete fusion between the membranous part of the occipital bone and the cartilaginous part. Again, it is a caution to you, because if you're going to deal with a child of that age, you may find there seems to be a little fissure between those two pieces of bone, and you may think that it is a fracture, but it isn't. It is not yet completely fused. When it gets completely fused, that's what you're seeing here, those pieces of bone all become continuous, and you will never see the break between them. This is a series of three different stages of human fetus, and in this particular stage, this is in the second trimester, you're seeing here the membrane part of the occipital bone. This is membrane, and here is endochondral. You see the piece of cartilage is still forming. I'm sorry, this is wrong. I'm going to eliminate it for a moment. Okay, we're going to go back now and do this properly, because what you're seeing here, this is the boundary. This is the membrane bone. This is the endochondral bone. Here's the bone, and here's still the cartilage. Okay, so this particular heavier bone that you're seeing here is the endochondrally formed bone of the condyle. Well, here is the membrane bone. Notice that you saw that in the mandible also. In the mandible, the intramembranously formed bone was more delicate, while the endochondral ossification gave heavier bone trabeculae. So that's the same thing that you're seeing here. The final bone that I want to talk to you about is the sphenoid. Again, the sphenoid is a mixed bone, forms in part endochondrally, in part intramembranously. And here the diagram shows it to you with all the different ossification centers. The ala orbitalis, orbitosphenoid, small wing, all of those terms are used, has a separate ossification center. There are two separate ossification centers that are known as presphenoids. Two separate ossification centers are known as basisphenoids. Those are all formed in the hypophyseal cartilage. Hypophyseal. This is ala orbitalis. This is ala temporalis. And now you're seeing that there are again a series of membrane bone structures that are added onto it. The greater wing is really completed by a large piece of membranous bone, and the pterygoid processes are also formed by membrane bone. My good friend Professor Kodama couple of years, quite more than a couple of years ago, 30 years ago, we had a nice meeting on the basic cranium. And what you're seeing here, I literally identified all of these different ossification centers. He came to 14, okay? I don't really want you to know about 14 ossification centers. Remember that there's one ossification center in the basisphenoid, one in the presphenoid, one in the basioccipital, always, of course, on they are bilateral, so there's two really. And what you're seeing here now is that by the time this is at birth, this is actually a section of the midface at birth, that the presphenoid and the basisphenoid now have already fused together. There used to be another synchondrosis between them, but that is gone. But the basioccipital and the basisphenoid, they are not fused, and you have here a piece of cartilage that remains, and that piece of cartilage remains throughout the growth period into adolescence. Usually it closes by age 16 to 18. So that is one area where you have still the possibility of growth. This is very much like a growth plate, and this is known as a synchondrosis. So we are now coming into the area of a synchondrosis. The same way that membrane bones, when they come together, they form sutures as joints. The synchondrosis are joints between adjacent endochondrally forming bones. So as long as you have different endochondral ossification centers, as long as they are not fused together, you have a cartilage joint which is known as a synchondrosis. You're seeing them here in this diagram shown up. Every one of these black things is an ossification center. This is presphenoid. This is basisphenoid. Here is basioccipital. And see, gradually, as these ossification centers expand, they come together and you end up with a few little synchondroses. This is the spheno-occipital synchondrosis. And this here is the presphenoid basisphenoid synchondrosis. This one disappears at birth, so it's gone at birth. The spheno-occipital continues on, so what you're seeing here, even though this diagram shows it, I have similar pictures that don't show it. But throughout much of the growth period, this is what you will see here, is that spheno-occipital synchondrosis, and by the time you reach adulthood, the synchondrosis is pretty much gone. It may not be completely gone. It may still be a little fibrocartilage structure, and that's why in the cranial base you see a split between the sphenoid and the occipital. If the cartilage had completely disappeared and the bones had fused, you wouldn't call it a separate sphenoid and a separate occipital bone. But because of this little break, there is, in fact, reason to speak of two separate bones, and that's what we're doing. Now, let's understand what a synchondrosis is. Synchondrosis, by definition, this is the lousiest picture I have, but I have nothing better at the moment. A synchondrosis is a bipolar growth plate, meaning that if you have a growth plate with all the various zones, small cell zones, zone of cell columns, hypertrophic zone, and then a zone of erosion, that is a unipolar situation, and that's a growth plate in a long bone. Although it starts out as a synchondrosis when the epiphyseal ossification center is still forming, but by the time you have complete growth going on, it's a unipolar growth plate that only is having these changes in this direction. In the case of a synchondrosis, it's bipolar, meaning that you have the same kind of changes going on in two directions. And that means that the small cell zone is here, and that you have two sets of proliferation zone here and proliferation zone here. You have two sets of maturation zones here and here, and you have two sets of hypertrophic zones here and here. So all the changes that you learned about in the growth plates, here they are going in both directions in mirror image. Okay? both direction, mirror image. Something that you should know about synchondroses. There are actually two synchondroses that you need to know about. The sphenooccipital, that's one, between basioccipital and basisphenoids, and that permits anteroposterior growth. That is something that allows anteroposterior growth at the cranial base. Very infrequently we talk about the others, but there are two other synchondroses, and they are jugular synchondroses that lie between the petrous parts of the temporal bones and the occipital condyles, and they permit growth in width. And let's see what they look like. And here they are. This is the location. They would be found in this area right here. So between the petrous part of the temporal bone and the occipital part of the synchondrose. Here's the occipital. Here's the petrous part. And just anterior to the jugular foramen. That is where you find these jugular synchondroses. So, this is then what I want you to know about. Sphenooccipital synchondroses between basioccipital and basisphenoid permits anteroposterior growth, and the two jugular synchondroses, which nobody talks about but do exist, permit growth in width. They probably are not talked about because we don't look at them, Dr. Yuan, in lateral films, huh? No, we never do. We don't make the pictures to show that kind of growth in width, but it is real, it's happening. Okay. Now, the growth of a long bone. Let's just briefly look at this. I know you know it, but it's, you can use a little refresher. As you know, this is a typical diagram of a long bone. And what you, please remember now that a long bone has three ossification centers. It has a diaphyseal ossification center, and it has usually two epiphyseal ossification centers. So the concept of multiple ossification centers in the bones of the that form from the chondrocranium is nothing new. That's not unusual. And what you find is that when these ossification centers first form, you have a structure here that is like a synchondrosis, which is bipolar. But once the epiphyses have completely expanded, the growth plate becomes unipolar. So for a little while it's like a synchondrosis, but then it becomes like the typical growth plate that you know, and you're seeing here the proliferation zone marked and the hypertrophic zone. And typically, of course, the growth plates allow the bones to form in length by moving the epiphyses further out. This was done, paper that I published a very long time ago with a bunch of engineers, and so we talked engineering, and essentially what we are showing was that M1 at T1 was over here, and at T2 it got to lie over here, and those relationships between these various points in the diaphysis did not change. Once they are formed, there is no further interstitial growth here. All the growth is of course occurring in this direction and in this direction. And that's what growth plates do. And of course, in addition, the growth plates, in addition to the growth plates, you also have periosteal growth, which allows for growth in width of the diaphyseal bone itself. Here are the zones of the growth plate. And for purposes of discussion, the small cell zone, these are the stem cells. They are giving rise to the new clones that are going to form the cell columns. The proliferative zones are roughly until this location here, and then you have a maturation zone. Maturation zone, nothing much changes in the looks of these cells, but what changes is the activity of these cells. The zone of maturation begins to produce different kinds of extracellular components, and importantly, the zone of maturation, those cells produce Indian hedgehog and produce receptors for parathyroid hormone related protein. And as you will remember, those are the two components that provide a negative feedback loop. Because what they do, they are the Indian hedgehog talks to the perichondrium, and the perichondrial cells, so IHH, signals to the perichondrium. The perichondrium cells are producing parathyroid hormone related protein, and that is being fed into the growth plate from the epiphyseal end. And as long as it can reach the cells in this maturation zone, they have receptors for hormone-related protein, and that allows them to respond to this protein by not going and differentiating further. So this inhibits further differentiation into hypertrophy. So for a while, these cells are slowed down. They will not have that further differentiation until the cells behind them have started to move and back up and move them out of the way. And once they get out of the way of where the parathyroid-related protein can reach them, now they are relieved and now they will undergo hypertrophy. So there is a point where they become liberated. They are no longer under the influence of PTHRP, and at that point they will undergo hypertrophy. But for a while they are kept from hypertrophying by this protein until which they actually call for themselves. This is kind of an interesting paracrine loop that you have here. It's kind of slowing things a little bit down. So the point is that in the proliferation zone you have mitosis under the positive influence of growth hormone, and that is then translated in production of IGF-1 by the chondrocytes, giving them the stimulus for proliferation. And then the entry into the hypertrophic zone is under the influence of this negative feedback loop, especially IHH and PTHRP. But once they get into the hypertrophic zone, there is apoptosis, cell death, and the cells are dying when there is the erosion, the vascular erosion. A couple of things that happen, one second before we go into the synchondrosis. The hypertrophic cells produce type 10 collagen, which allows and permits mineralization, so that is important for the mineralization. They also produce matrix metalloproteinase 9, which allows for breakdown of some of the matrix products. So there's a change in the extracellular matrix as the cells themselves begin to change. All right. Synchondrosis then, usually they are too large to get all on one slide and get a good picture of it. This is the human synchondrosis at birth, and all of this is small cell. Okay, so typically the small cell zone in human growth plates and in synchondrosis is very wide, much narrower in rabbits. And then what you're seeing here is little bits of cell columns. Not huge. The length of a cell column is pretty much correlated with the rate of longitudinal growth that occurs at these growth plates and synchondrosis. So you look at the growth plates and the synchondrosis, and you see the length of the columns, and it's growing, but not terribly fast. And the same thing is true for the hypertrophic cells. Hypertrophic zone is not huge, really not. And so they give you a fair idea of how fast growth is taking place. By the time you reach adolescence, what happens now is that the cell columns become even smaller and the hypertrophic zone becomes smaller. These are two sides of the same synchondrosis. On this side, there is still some growth, but on the other side, growth is over. And how can you tell that? Because what you're seeing here is, instead of these bone trabeculae running in this direction and still having vascular erosion here you have a bone plate that literally covers the surface of the cartilage. And as long as that bone plate is there, you pretty much are done with the longitudinal growth. If at some point there is a growth stimulus, it can very easily start up again and the bone plate will be resorbed and it can still go a little bit. And that frequently happens at the end of the growth of long bones, at the end of growth in the cranial base. There will be these periods of a bone plate being formed, and then it will be resorbed again and you continue growing a little bit longer. In radiographs you can see them as little white lines. They are known as Harris lines. And so that is something. Final thing, just one of those things that I like to show every now and then because it's my old thesis, or at least part of my thesis, and that has to do with cartilage canals. And cartilage canals, typically in larger cartilages, you do see cartilage canals present. Here, a little bit of capillaries. And here you have them a little bit bigger, these arterioles, going into the cartilage of the synchondrosis. And this is something that I published way, way long ago. Here is a small cartilage at 111 millimeter, 107 millimeter. And at birth, the bar in each case is 2 millimeters, gives you an idea. And what you're seeing here, these structures over here, are cartilage canals. They are not there for the endochondral ossification. They are there for the nutrition of that very large piece of cartilage. That's something that we have demonstrated over that work quite nicely. Okay, let's take a 5-minute break and then we'll go for the lab introduction.